very, very alien territory that we're moving into today, and I think particularly an alien territory for those of us who've grown up in the West as well. I think the idea of some things being clean and unclean is something which other cultures and other parts of the world will understand far more instinctively, I think, than we do. Which begs the question of, do we have our own version of that? And I think we do. I wonder, let's have hands raised. Hands up if your household is one where shoes are taken off at the front door. Who's got his shoes off at the front door? That's most of us. Okay, yeah, that's it. So exactly, so that's an example, isn't it? That's something which is, or another one, and there's so many more we can think of. A 5-second rule, if food drops on the floor, you know. Do you wash your hands after picking your nose, if you ever even do that? In some cultures, it's considered the height of politeness to belch loudly at the table after a good meal. And again, just the other sort of these examples, people in the Arabic-speaking world really just don't tend to keep dogs as pets. It's just seen they're unclean. Why would I want that in my house? And so we live in a world where there are definitely rules, depending on where we are, about what is clean and what is unclean. We'll have different standards of that in different areas. And what we see today in Leviticus is that there's no detail of daily life for these Israelites that is too small to be important to God. And so the way that Leviticus does this is by dividing things up into clean and unclean. And so to read these is to enter into a symbolic world. Everything here in this book is loaded with significance. And we'll see in a few moments that some of the things that make you unclean in Leviticus are perfectly natural and perfectly good. And so to be unclean isn't in itself a bad thing. It doesn't make you a bad person. But if you don't deal with it in the right way, it becomes a problem. And so the key verse, a key verse, is in chapter 15, verse 31. You must keep the Israelites separate from things that make them unclean, so that they will not die in their uncleanness for defiling my dwelling place, which is among them. Still begs the question, what did the gecko ever do to you? In a few moments, we're going to look at how and why Jesus makes a radical difference to this, and how we read and how we understand it, how we interpret it in 2019 as followers of Jesus in Sutton. But before we do that, what I want us to do is go on a quick jog through these chapters so that we can better understand the content. And so again, if you wish to read along, we're beginning at page 111 on chapter 11. This is the kosher food laws. This is clean and unclean food. So if any of you have got Jewish, Muslim, Hindu friends or other religions, and I surely hope you do, you'll know that there are certain foods that certain people of different cultures won't eat for religious reasons. And so chapter 11 divides up different animals into categories. So you've got animals that chew the cud, i.e. kind of herbivores who kind of eat grass, who ruminate, and have a split hoof, then those are the ones that you can eat. If they fail to fall into either of those categories, you may not. So the pig, they look at and they think, well, the hoof is split, but it doesn't eat grass. It doesn't chew the cud in the same way that other animals do. So you can't eat that. In verse 9, if we look down, you look at creatures living in the waters and the seas. Sea animals, if they have fins and scales, then you can eat them, but don't touch the ones that don't. So that's verse 13 that says, verse 11. So those, anything that lives in the sea but isn't a fish is unclean. We get in verse 13 onwards, we're talking about predatory and scavenger birds that seem to be pretty much out. Any animal that eats another animal is considered unclean. Verse 20, most insects are no. However, you can eat locusts, catydids, crickets or grasshoppers because they have joined legs for hopping on the ground. So they're hopping creatures and they're made to hop and therefore you can eat them. Verse 29, I asked Bruce to read that bit, of all the animals that move around on the ground are particularly, they're detestable to you. And I wonder if there's something a little bit, again, we'll go into this in a moment or two, but something that crawls on the ground, I think if you think of the imagination of ancient Israel, is a little bit too close to a snake. And if you think back to the Genesis chapter 2, Genesis chapter 3, sorry, the snake in the Garden of Eden, crawls on its belly. And so perhaps, yeah, so I think part of the logic behind this, if it's a bit too snaky, well, a way to remember that you're a person who stays away from sin is, well, you don't touch or eat any animal like that. There are plenty of theories around about why some particular animals are allowed and some aren't. And this is something that has got kind of anthropologists and biblical scholars having all sorts of different ideas. And it's really hard, I think, to find one particular thing which kind of makes sense of all of it. But I think I have found it, not myself, but reading around some of the different books. So one interpretation of this is it's just about hygiene. So there are certain animals which are unclean to eat because actually there's just more diseases in them. But it doesn't really add up, because the two things there are certain animals which we know other people in that part of the world could eat. Camels are a good example, considered a delicacy for the desert dwellers of Arabia. But actually, and there was no health issues there, but that was something which Israel weren't allowed to eat. And likewise, if it was about that, then when Jesus came and said, we don't do that anymore, then surely if it was about hygiene and keeping safe, then those rules would continue. And then the other one is, it's arbitrary. That's another one. God just said, let me give them some rules to make sure that they love me. You know, let's just find out and just give them some arbitrary rules, and they can, yeah, so they can know they're holy because they won't eat this. And I think the one idea I've come across that's most plausible is that there is some idea of wholeness and normality and the way the world ought to be underlying the concept of cleanness and holiness. So each type of animal, land, sea and air, has a kind of normative, normal way of moving, of being, and anything that contravenes that is unclean. So if you're in the sea, be a fish. You know, that's really straightforward. Fish are in the sea. That's how sea things move. So anything that's in the sea, like a prawn, that doesn't move like a fish, just doesn't really come under that idea of normality, about this is what a sea animal should be like. And likewise, for the symbolic world of Leviticus, holiness means, as far as the animals are concerned, conforming to the class in which you belong. So we have this English phrase, don't we? Neither fish nor flesh nor fowl. And it's coming from that idea. So this is, I think, the best, for me, it's the best way of understanding it, is as we go through these clean and unclean rules, there's this idea of a kind of normative of what different categories of animals should be like. And anything that isn't like that is unwhole and unclean. This is the same reason that from the Levites, the priestly class, if you had a bodily deformity, you weren't allowed to be a priest because you were not conforming the class. So again, so we today rightly enjoy the diversity and strangeness of God's creation. You know, so we love that. But I can imagine, you know, David Attenborough, if he'd been filming during the days of Leviticus, people would have responded in quite a different way. The people of Israel would have felt quite consciously that there was a sense of order to how things should be, and obeying these laws were a way that they identified themselves as holy. Each day you'd be making decisions to remind yourself that you belong to God. So you'd have this life that was set apart by purity and integrity. This was symbolic, done in a symbolic way for them, but purity and integrity are things that a Christian will crave too. I know, so we're going to just glance through the rest of these. You can read these at your leisure later. On page 113, you have the rules about purification after childbirth. Again, nothing wrong. It's a good thing in this world for you to have for children. There wasn't anything shameful about that, but nevertheless, there was an idea of cleanness after that. Chapter 13, skin diseases. And if we turn over to page 114, we go down to 115, regulations about mildew. So that's kind of rot or fungus or something like that in your house. Chapter 14, on page 115, is cleaning from infectious skin diseases. Cleaning from mildew, second half of that chapter. And then in chapter 15, bodily discharges, in particular ones relating to sex, like ejaculate or a woman's monthly discharge. And again, this is deeply symbolic. What's going on there in these readings? Is there anything wrong with being a normal functioning human being? And the answer is no. But in the symbolic world of Leviticus, blood and sexual fluids represented life force. And so anything that seemed to take away from life force, even symbolically, had a kind of ritual uncleanness. And it's the same with the skin conditions. We just skirted, we didn't even read those. The skin conditions that were treated most seriously were the ones that made the skin white and flaky like a corpse. So this is saying any contact with things symbolic of death, you know, dead bodies, snaky animals, skin disease, blood, bodily fluids, rendered you impure. And so again, it's not wrong to be impure, but you'd have to wait a few days and take a bath before being pronounced pure. So what is wrong is barging into God's holy presence when you're in an impure state. It's a violation. So you remain outside until you're sorted. And so this system is a way of teaching Israel that they need to keep away from things of death. And so it's using these things which aren't in themselves deathly, but represent somehow death. So in the normal run of things as well, eating, drinking, sex, illness, there's this really nice way to know that you're clean and you've got a way to re-enter worship life. You're sorted. But what if you can't get sorted? What if something persists? Well, the sense of shame for people who are perpetually unclean would be unbearable. You know, in the West, we do shame in a very particular way. It's very private, it's very personal, it's about self-esteem, we hide. We may evaluate ourselves as worthless or unlovable. If only they knew. That's the way we think about shame in the West, if only they knew. And so shame in the Western, in our culture and in the context we're looking at today is not guilt from things you've done wrong, but things that have happened to you or things that you are. You know, we'll have our own triggers like that, you know, illness, being deserted, addiction, past bullying or abuse or trauma, loneliness, embarrassment. There's these kind of things which bring us shame, and we tend to do that in the West by kind of retreating into ourselves. But in the Middle Eastern culture, in the culture of Leviticus, it's very different, it's very public. It's other people looking at you in a negative way. If only they didn't know, you would think. Now, for those of you who've grown up in small villages, you might get already a bit of a sense of what that feels like. You know, and at its worst, this kind of prolonged shame leads to a kind of public ostracism. So Jesus came to show us a different kind of clean and make us a different kind of clean. One of the ways that Jesus upset the religious authorities of his day was ignoring and transgressing these rules about ritual cleanliness. In chapter 7 of Mark, we don't have time to read it today, Jesus' friends sit down at a dinner party with some Pharisees, and they didn't wash their hands before eating in the proper ritual way, and the Pharisees eating with them are appalled at their shameless behavior. They ask Jesus, why not? And if you go on to read the passage yourself, you see that they probably regret asking the question, because Jesus gives them both barrels for a good 30 verses or so. And he says not because he's not giving them grief because they obey the rules. He's giving them grief because he sees they're hypocrites and they're fakers, because he sees that they have all this ritual cleanness on the outside, but inside is a different matter altogether. And again, you'll read this yourselves later if you wish, but Jesus goes on to say it's not what goes into you that makes you unclean. You know, the food you eat goes into your stomach and not into your heart. Don't I know it? It's what comes out of you that shows how clean you are. Jesus says what is inside of you is not clean. Our hearts are the things that need cleaning. It's going to take a lot more than avoiding some kinds of food. There's a law of tidying up that I came across as I was reading around this, or a law of cleaning, and it's quite simple. In order for something to be clean, something else must remain dirty. When you clean your house, you're basically transferring dirtiness, aren't you, from your house to dustpans and cloths and sprays, and then if you end up cleaning those away. But there ends up being a repository for the dirt, and so something else has to get dirty. And so for the people of ancient Israel, this meant we couldn't go towards God and his dwelling place. We couldn't go near him because we will get God dirty if we go close. We see from this reading in Mark that we looked at, this woman who'd been bleeding for 12 years, that there is only one safe place to take our uncleanness. There's only one place to take our pain and our shame and our embarrassment, and that is to Jesus.
He's the one who opens his arms wide and says, bring me your shame, bring me your uncleanness. So this woman, we heard about in Mark's gospel, she'd been 12 years in physical pain. She'd had this blood flow that just would not stop. So there's a physical pain there, but there's also an unbearable, burning public shame. She'd spent all of her money on doctors, and she had nothing that she could do about it. And if we remember the reading that Bruce gave us, anything she touched, anything she sat on, was unclean. If you sat on a chair that she had sat on, you yourself would be unclean. Anybody who touched her would be unclean. She couldn't go to the temple. She couldn't be any part of public life. She couldn't even worship God. She was cut off. Again, this Leviticus system works brilliantly if you in the normal run of things, when you can get yourself tidied up and come back to God and you feel, hooray, I'm back. But if you're not, it goes on for 12 years. And she sees Jesus, she sees God's Holy One approaching, and he's in touching distance. If I can just touch his clothes, I will be healed. You can imagine the adrenaline coursing through her. She knows she's not allowed to be in public. She's not allowed to touch anybody, let alone a holy man like Jesus. She takes her chance, she squeezes through, and she makes what must have only been the most tentative of touches onto Jesus' clothes. And immediately she knows in herself, she senses it, that the bleeding has stopped. She feels herself well for the first time in a very, very long while indeed. And if she'd slipped away at that point, or she tried to slip away, and we would never have heard of her. But Jesus feels it too. Whole crowd are gathering and prodding at Jesus. You know, he's in the middle of this maelstrom of humanity, and he notices this one frail touch. He notices that power leaving him. He stops. Who touched my clothes? And you can imagine the woman at this point, given all we've heard, given the rules there, she's terrified. Who touched my clothes? The disciples are having a laugh. Aren't you Jesus? There's hundreds of people around us. Who touched you? Lots of people did, but Jesus wants this to be personal. She's been healed, but Jesus wants this to be a personal interaction. He doesn't just want to leave her better, but he wants to get to know her. The woman's terrified. She knows the law, trembling with fear, knees knocking. She kneels before Jesus, expecting both barrels, and Jesus is delighted with her. Daughter, your faith has healed you. Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. Go in peace and be freed from your shame. Go in peace and be freed from your uncleanness. When God walks among us, he doesn't get violated by our uncleanness. Our uncleanness gets wiped away and destroyed by his holiness and his goodness and his compassion. His holiness is enough for us, if only we will come to him. So the question for each one of us is, do you need to bring something to Jesus today? Is there some kind of shame, some kind of uncleanness, some kind of pain that you're carrying? Anything you're so used to carrying that you don't even notice it anymore? Do you need to hear the words of Christ today? Go in peace and be freed from your suffering. And we're, as always, very, very happy to follow up, to pray, to talk afterwards. But for now, let's pray as we finish. Gracious God, we thank you that you are no stranger to shame, you're no stranger to guilt, you're no stranger to our pain. Thank you that you know what it's like to be cast outside. Thank you that you reach into our lives, that you speak words of freshness, of wholeness, of healing. Might we be hungry for your touch today. Come by your Spirit and reach into our lives, that your Son might be glorified. Amen.